Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Oh. It's cold in here. It's really cold. Sorry, I clipped real bad there.
I know. It's super cold.
Yeah.
Hey, do you know that, I mean, I'm sure there are millennials who listen to this who are about to laugh at me explaining this term to a couple of other old dudes. But do you know the term horny on Maine?
I have heard it before.
Do you know what it means?
Old dude.
You know,
apparently, if you are a reasonable young person,
yes,
you don't just have one social media account like us dinosaurs. You actually have two. You have one one for your friends, and then you have the public-facing one that job interviewers might look at as they're researching.
Yeah, the Xennials invented that, you know.
Well, so, and I was hanging out with the incredible, oh my God, these women from the, what's that?
There we go. We're good now. Somebody's phone was making a phone noise.
At New York Comic Con this summer, I spent a whole evening with part of the costumes and also prop department of Sleep No More. Amazing group of women. Really, really brilliant, funny, irreverent. We just had the best time hanging out. And they told me horny on Maine. And horny on Maine means I like this so much, I'm going to express deep, abiding pleasure about it on my front-facing social channel.
Public one.
Not on the private one.
I don't have a private one.
On Maine, not the state.
Yeah.
Maine as in my primary.
Yeah. Horny on Maine means I'm front-facing, excited about
this. Thought you really loved lobster fishermen.
Right.
I don't have a private Twitter. I got rid of Facebook. I don't have Instagram.
Well, so I remember when I first signed up for Twitter, I was anonymous for about 2 weeks.
Oh, really? You didn't tell anybody?
I didn't tell anyone. Don't try this.
Yeah.
And I wasn't holding back revealing who I was. I wasn't saying my name, but, you know, I'd post pictures here and there. And I just remember, like, after week one, someone tweeted, because that back then they would assign you random people to follow.
Oh, yeah. I remember when this happened. We were Maximum PC, and I remember because you were, I think, the first famous person I remember seeing on Twitter that was like, oh, that's somebody I would probably follow.
And I remember one guy going, by some weird grace of an algorithm, I seem to be following Adam Savage from Mythbusters.
Oh, boy.
Simpler times.
Yeah.
So I want to get this out of the way, because since we've last podcasted, I have lost an important family member.
I'm so sorry, Adam.
Yeah. Our dog, Huxley. And I'd just like to go over this a little. I'd like to unpack this with you all a little bit.
Let's do our weekly therapy session.
we got Huxley 13 and a half years ago at Berkeley Humane. It's the first dog I have ever been lucky enough to live with. My father was terribly allergic, so we didn't have dogs growing up. We had cats, but I am a dog person. Cats are fine. Cats are great. I love dogs more.
Dogs are codependent in a way that makes them very compatible with me.
And there's a way in which you commune and communicate with a dog that feels so immediate. And, you know, when you really understand what your dog's gestures mean and they understand what yours mean, it feels like you're opening up new sections of the universe, really. You're like, you're communicating.
The only creatures that stare you deep in the eyes as they're going number two.
Well, this was, you know, I've talked about Huxley before, but he was, and everyone's dog is remarkable to their family.
Of course.
Full that. Huxley was a deeply beautiful soul of a dog.
He even, what, 7 years ago, 8 years ago when we met him, I was like, oh, that dog is an old soul. He was relatively young then.
Yeah. And he would come up to you and he would look you in the eye and he'd sort of hang out with you. He was not treat stupid. He was he didn't have ADHD, which most dogs do. he was really focused, and he was a super important member of our family. In the first few years we had him, he slept with each boy every other night. One chose odds, one chose evens, and Huxley slept with them. Oh. And like he would do big or little spoon. He was an awesome dog to sleep with. Like just the, you know.
He didn't try to ratchet you off the bed.
No, not at all. And he's old. You know, he was old. He was 14 and a half, pushing 15. And we knew that we could see that he was getting old. And in the last couple of weeks, it was getting more and more. And then a week ago Saturday, we woke up. And at that point, he was sort of waking up multiple times a night needing to pee. and needing to just go out on our deck because you weren't going to get him down the stairs at a time. And he'd just pee on the deck, and that's fine. And then Saturday morning, he woke up and he was peeing at around 7 a.m. on the deck, and his legs just went out from under him. And I was, at that point, I was so closely monitoring him that I actually caught him before he hit the ground and lifted him up, and still peeing, carried him into the bedroom and laid him on his bed. And he sort of hung out there for about an hour as we were kind of assessing. You know, he didn't want to stand. He was really, his breathing was really shallow. And we called the vet, and we have this wonderful vet who comes to the house. And by the way, that's actually not much more expensive than actually going to the animal hospital. Blue Pearl is the animal hospital we now go to in Daly City.
Daly City, one or the other.
And we called the vet, and she said, that doesn't sound good. We have someone on call. They can be there later this afternoon. And they came at 4:30, and we said you should come prepared to euthanize because it feels like that's where we're at. In the meantime, a whole bunch of local friends who knew Huxley really well came by and spent time saying hello and goodbye. And that was it. You know, there's no, it's that great line from Watchmen, doesn't every relationship end in tragedy? And the answer is yes. And so it's not about whether there's going to be a tragedy. It's about how you want to go through that tragedy. And when the vet came, he was remarkable at laying out for us the situation with Huxley without giving any bias about his opinion about what we ought to do. He said, here's what I see, here's what I'm experiencing, here's what I think might happen, here's how we would investigate X, Y, Z. And we said, okay, it sounds like it's really bad. And he said, yeah. And we said, our choices seem pretty simple. He said, yes, either we euthanize him here or we rush him to the hospital and subject him to a battery of huge tests under general anesthesia that he might not wake up from, et cetera. And we were like, that makes our call really easy.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. I know this is emotional, but I'm going to just talk to the last bit. You know, you do it in two stages. You give them a sedative to relax them and put them to sleep, and then you use the big sedative to stop their systems. And we gave him the minor sedative, and as that started to take effect, he took a deep breath, and Maggie, our other dog, who's a terrier about half Huxley's size, jumped up on the couch and laid down at his head, and he lifted his head and he laid it down on her. And the last sound we heard him make was this as he put his head on Maggie. And it was they were so inseparable, and it was so beautiful. And we got to put our hands on him, you know, and say goodbye. And we were right there. And, you know, I was so sad, and I am so sort of bereft and at sixes and sevens. And yet I am also so surprised that the prevailing emotion is one of just nothing but gratitude of the time we got to spend and the way we got to say goodbye.
That's
And you know, I know so many people have pets that they care about, and I just want to tell you, if you're dreading this moment, it can be done in a way that feels like real closure, and I feel so lucky for that to have happened.
I mean, this is the first, Chloe passed earlier this year. We didn't talk about it on the podcast.
Yeah.
It was the first time I'd had a pet that lived with me as an adult.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we had horses and dogs and the whole thing, but I didn't know how I would handle that as an adult. And it's awful. It is when you have a pet that's lived for as long as Huxley lived, as long as Chloe lived, because she was 14 too. You're just grateful for the time you have with them.
Yeah, exactly. And Maggie's getting all of the love we would have normally been spreading out between the two of them. And she seems a little bit at loose ends.
I was going to say, how does she? She knows what she knows. Something's happened.
You know, somebody. Where was I recently where someone said, if you could ask your pet one question, what would it be? And I thought, okay, well, if we're going into fantasy camp of like that you could actually have a conversation with your pet and they could answer a question for real, my question would be, what is their experience of memory like? Because I suspect it's radically different than ours, but I have no idea what that actually means.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, right? She knows something's different. she knows something's different. She actually, the first couple of days, she was clearly super sleep deprived, because where normally during a day, if no one was home, which happens for 2 or 3 hours at a time here and there, she and Huxley would be sleeping. But not right after Huxley passed. She was up on the couch barking at passersby for the first time in 10 years. Wow. Yeah. And a friend of mine said, she's barking Shiva. She is sleeping more now. But so that, yeah, it's been an intense week. And I also put Thing One on a plane on Saturday morning to move to another city. And now both my sons, Thing One and Thing Two, are living in cities more than 1,000 miles away.
Wow.
Yeah. It's been a real, I won't say butt kicker, because all of this is really, you know, it's life. Except that it's been an intense start to the year.
Well, I mean, the thing, honestly, I travel a lot for work. It's nothing like what you travel for work. But the thing that I was always worried about as Chloe started her decline was that I wouldn't be around, or I'd have to take the emergency flight and try to get back in time, so that it wasn't something that Gina had to deal with on her own.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was really grateful that it happened at a time that, not that was convenient, because that sounds awful, but that I was there
and
I could spend experience. I could spend the, you know, because we had a day or day and a half, and we knew, and I was really grateful that I was there, and that that was the only focus, and mm-hmm. that there wasn't anything else, and it was good.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
If you're on the fence about a rescue dog, go find a rescue dog. Both of our dogs came from rescue shelters, and they're just the most wonderful, amazing animals and beings. And we will eventually, I think, find another dog to live in our house. Mm-hmm. And we're taking that sort of on advisement as mm-hmm. it comes.
Well, one of the things that we've been doing, because we're not quite ready. Well, I think everybody else in my family is, but I'm not. We have gone to shelters and mm-hmm. done shelters always are excited about having volunteers come to walk the dogs.
Oh yeah.
And it's a great way if you want to get some dog time in, but don't necessarily want to have a dog.
Ooh, that's a really good idea. I really like that.
You can go and do some dog walks and you can meet a bunch of awesome dogs. And, that's basically, that is what we have done. 'Cause I like the way dogs smell.
Oh, man. Yeah. No, I know.
Yeah.
I did Margaret Cho's podcast last night at Cobb's Comedy Club as part of Sketchfest. What a goddamn she seems awesome. Legend she
yeah,
is.
She seems rad.
Oh, she's amazing. She's super. I mean, she's just we know that she's funny. She's brilliant. A real incredible human being. And she has a lovely little chihuahua named Lucia, who I hung out with last night a bit.
Well, that's
delightful
awesome.
Getting some dog licks in.
Yeah. Yeah. If I had anything to do differently, the thing that I would do is that we waited until Chloe was too old to think about getting a second dog. I would space them out let's say five. We didn't want to get a young dog when she was 12 and she was going to, it was going to grind her down. So we would have gotten, I think I would have gotten another dog when she was seven.
Yeah.
The first dog to teach a second dog.
Got Maggie when Huxley was 2.5, and so she's only a year and a half younger than him.
Mm-hmm. She's also a longer, terriers usually
live to 40, they, right?
I mean, we had a fox terrier when I was a kid who was 18, I think, or 19 when she finally let loose the mortal coil.
Crazy.
And look, she had miles.
Yeah,
good life.
All right.
Hey, so
having talked about that,
yeah, you want to talk about something really upbeat?
let's totally move on to what else do we want to talk about?
Today? Oh my god, we're going to talk about Parasite,
but I haven't seen it yet.
God damn it, Will! It's such an amazing movie.
But at least we can talk about Knives Out.
No, I haven't seen that. Funnily enough, in discussing the media we've been imbibing lately, Norm and I realized that we both watched the exact same episode of West Wing from season 3 last night.
Which one?
Where they're thinking about replacing the vice president.
Coins.
Oh, and they
coins.
Reveal
coins.
Coins.
Yes. The Texan.
He had some sort of impropriety or something, right? I can't remember.
No, it's just the math didn't. The math was not going to be in their favor.
Right. The electoral math. Yeah. And he's a recovering alcoholic. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was.
This is fine because, first of all, West Wing is 20 years old. But if I was listening to this podcast and it was a spoiler and you still want to watch The West Wing, you're not going to remember this.
It doesn't matter.
Frankly,
also, there's almost no plot point of West Wing you could spoil that would actually harm any given episode.
Man, those cliffhangers at the ends of the seasons often,
to be sure,
are not like, especially. I mean, actually, I've already spoiled them because the idea that there's cliffhangers at the end of the season is probably the spoiler on the first season.
That's how TV shows work back then. Network TV.
I guess so, yeah.
I still have on one of my regular playlists the recording of Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits from Wembley Stadium that is the closer for season two.
Two Cathedrals.
When he's in the church. Yeah, yeah. Two Cathedrals.
One of the best episodes of television of all time, or so I've been told.
I watched now the first three episodes, I think, of For All Mankind, the Apple.
Yep.
Was it Apple TV Plus? Is that what they call it? Apple's TV service.
Yeah, this is Ron D. Moore's show.
Yeah. I'm hooked. They did a good job with the space stuff. It's a huge ensemble cast. So the setup, if you don't know, and this isn't a spoiler, is what if the Russians had landed on the moon before we did? So the idea is that sometime between Apollo 10 and Apollo 11, the Russians land the first man on the moon, and we are shook. Nixon is pissed. Werner von Braun is chagrined. And like a lot of the early episodes are like, what if on Apollo 10, when they came within 1,000 feet of the surface, they just, you know, gone the rest of the way instead of firing the rockets coming back. Right. Like there's congressional hearings. It is a big drama in the West Wing kind of way.
Alternate reality, alternate history, world building.
Yeah. And they've done a lovely job kind of thinking through the implications of what would happen. But also like the sets are great. The period stuff is good. I think my hunch is it's the kind of like, hey, this is what NASA, you know, it's the Martian kind of NASA set where it looks pretty fancy for 1960s NASA.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a lot of big wooden tables and stuff that I think probably would have been Formica in the real world. But they did a lovely job recreating the Soviet lander that only there's like three of, I think.
Right.
They did a really great job with the spacesuits and the controls, it all looks very like they did a really good job, you know, doing the homework.
That's nice. That's awesome.
I've been enjoying it. I would recommend it wholeheartedly.
I watched the night Huxley passed. We all were sort of at loose ends and trying to figure out what to do. And we put up, we knew we wanted a movie that was like just a mood that would just wash over us.
Yeah.
And we watched In the Mood for Love, ooh, which is a Wong Kar-wai film.
Yes.
Wong Kar-wai, Hong Kong filmmaker, famously used a really brilliant Australian director of photography. And I bring up the DP because the first time I saw In the Mood for Love, the most cohesive thing I thought at the end was I've never known anything about color, because the colors that comprise every frame of this movie are so amazing and so shocking. And the textures and the depth of each frame and the way he holds shots just makes me feel like I'm watching an alternate version of filmmaking.
And that's the same DP that went on to Hero.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Oh, the Jet Li movie?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
Also full of color.
That's also amazing color. Yeah.
Yep.
And so In the Mood for Love is a manners drama about two Hong Kong residents who like each other and they have a friendship. Hmm. But there's more to it than that. And it is seriously one of my favorite movies. It's so beautiful. Really worth seeing. Wong Kar-wai, all of his films, his whole canon of film, his whole filmography is really important and great.
So after Joker got 11 Academy Award nominations, I sat down and watched Joker.
Yeah.
It is definitely not a perfect film. It is an unbelievable performance by Joaquin Phoenix. And I think if it hadn't been marketed as, hey, this is the movie about the Joker, I would have received it differently.
Oh, really?
Better or worse?
Better.
Oh, wow.
I think if it had been, look, this is a once upon a time in Hollywood situation for me. If this hadn't been a Joker origin story, if it was just about one man's descent into madness.
Falling down, yeah.
Yeah. Like, it would have been fascinating.
Right.
His performance is, it's riveting. It evokes a ton of sympathy in this character who has, you know, very clear problems and has had a horrible life. It's a parable that is that illustrates why we shouldn't like throw away large portions of society because they're inconvenient or it's expensive.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But the fact that it is the Joker origin story kind of undermines all of that stuff.
Oh, right. It plays against its own. Okay.
Yeah. Like if it was Michael Douglas in Falling Down and it's about, you know, yeah, like it was, it's, I was fascinated. I was really like, I started kind of like doing a crossword and watching it in the background. And about midway through the first act, I was like, oh, I'm going to actually, you know, put the phone down and watch this and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Okay.
So I'm watching it.
I don't know that it's like, my guess is that one of you is going to like it and one of you is not. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I'm
not
going to say any difference so far. So
I'm hedging. I'm hedging right. Real hard here. Ah,
nice.
That's not going to convince me to watch it.
No. Yeah, no, it's it was not what I was expecting. It is not Jared Leto with a bunch of tattoos and a broken, what is it? What
knives all pointed in an array.
Well, didn't he have one, a forehead tattoo that was like damaged or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, he had scars on his face.
Yeah.
What got you to watch The West Wing again?
Julia was watching it as comfort food.
Mm. It is comfort food. Watching it today is very strange.
It's astounding how good the ensemble is.
Gina and I rewatched the entirety up to like midway through the fourth season.
I've never watched any of the non-Aaron Sorkin episodes. So
five, six, seven.
Yeah, neither have I.
I never.
Well, we were watching
Not even like a policy, like I will never watch them. It's just I've never gotten around to it.
We were watching in the lead up to the 2016 election and then stopped mid-November early November for reasons that are, you know.
Yeah.
That's
why I stopped watching Veep.
Yeah,
it felt too real.
Once the administration moved beyond farce, then Veep just didn't seem like it was real. Yeah,
no. But it's a show about competent people.
Yeah. Yes,
incredibly competent people.
Well, also, I realized the structure of the show is sort of fascinating because almost everything that drives the plot of West Wing happens off camera.
Oh, always. Yeah, right?
They don't show it.
And so it's a procedural in which you're simply with the management team.
Well, it's as if Law and Order didn't open with somebody getting murdered every week. Right?
Yeah, but it's also as if Law and Order was only the people who were doing the desk research.
The operators at 911.
Right? And it's that's a kind of a fascinating, it was fascinating to think about that frame. And I realized there's probably a lot more to unpack about that show from that vantage point about what that means dramatically. It's like, Bill Prady, showrunner and creator of Big Bang Theory, and I were talking at one point about the Muppets because he got a start writing for the Muppets and
was producer
on the new Muppet show. And I said, you know, I realized that Rolf is the only Muppet without neuroses. And he said, oh, yeah, that's why he's so hard to write for. That's why we always make him the bartender.
I love Ralph as the bartender in the Muppet movie.
That's why
you have
to do that.
Yeah.
You have to make him the bartender because he's the tabla rasa.
Oh, yeah, I got problems. Yeah. the thing that strikes me going back and watching The West Wing, I've only been in the actual West Wing maybe twice, and I was always shocked at how small everything is.
Dude, I was telling Julia, I was like, I think it's a lot smaller.
The show expands all the rooms, like Roosevelt Room.
No, I think the show does a pretty good job compared to like a movie set in the West, like American President or Dave or whatever. Like there is the big conference room is the Situation Room, which is tiny.
The Situation Room is
everyone's
really
seen,
small.
Seen the photos of the real Situation
Room. And the dining room, room which is next
like
to the Situation
tables
Room
or six
is
tables or
really small.
The the cabinet room is probably the biggest room in the West Wing. That even the Oval Office is tiny.
They even use the cabinet room on the show The West Wing?
Yeah, because it's where they often have, like, if somebody needs to duck into a room, I feel like Rob Lowe and Bradley Whitford C.J. Crade.
Allison Janney.
Allison Janney.
Who looks so young in the first season.
They all are, like, 12.
I know.
they often duck into the cabinet room. It's the room with the fancy big wooden table.
Okay.
The big, like, conference table. It's where John Goodman sits down when they have that meeting with John
Goodman. It's more like a rabbit warren than the show leads you to believe.
Now, I have a question about the structure, the physical structure of that set, because they built that on the soundstage, right? And you can tell when they're in the Oval Office, when they look outside, it's a soundstage. Mm-hmm. It's not the real sky, right? But I've noticed that when they do the walk and talks, which the show is known for, that there are cuts where they go between a wall and it looks like it's supposed to be, you know, 1917 style. It's supposed to be continuous, but it's maybe either they've stopped shooting.
My guess is they unwrapped it all.
Or that they've, you know, that room isn't actually an extra room. Is it the case that it was a continuous set that they just
that I'm not sure
shot
about.
Around?
I don't know.
And for people who watch The West Wing, can they draw that set from memory?
Yeah.
Can they like draw the layout from all the...
As another interesting question, I remember running into somebody who... I ran into somebody, who, I can't remember who it was, was telling me they shot a movie that was had to take place in the White House. And it turns out that there's like six Oval Offices around the United States.
Oh, yeah, in different presidential libraries.
In different presidential libraries, in different sets and museums. And different movies will go and rent some museum's Oval Office set to film
it. It's like in China where they have the palace, Forbidden Palace. They have like a dozen of those in different parts of China as theme parks that the movie studios will use.
Since they can't shoot in the real one.
Right.
Wow.
And then they'll close off for a day.
That's really cool.
And the next day it's a theme park.
Wow. Yeah, so I've been in... My parents used to do a lot of business with the presidential libraries, so I got to go. You get to go spend a lot of time in the presidential library.
Wow. What's the best presidential library to go to, regardless of your liking of president?
The Reagan one is amazing because it has the old Air Force Ones, and you can go in, or at least last time I was there 15 years ago.
It's
you
here
can
in still California.
Go in,
yeah?
It's in like Southern California someplace. That one's pretty good. I feel like there's one. There's only presidential libraries for relatively recent presidents. I think the Eisenhower one was really good. I can't remember. It was in Missouri someplace, I think.
Mm.
And the Lyndon B. Johnson one in
I've only been to
Dallas.
Johnson.
We didn't go in.
That's not in Dallas. It's
It's in
Austin.
Austin. Yeah.
It's on campus.
We didn't go in because it was a kind of expensive ticket when we were there.
I don't remember.
But I went there when I was a kid, and that one was pretty good.
That one has a limo. Yeah.
But the Reagan one, getting to see the old planes was pretty rad. And it's also about Reagan, who was a Hollywood star. So, like, there's non-politics of stuff of interest
a little
to non-politics.
Something for everybody,
yeah, exactly. It's not just Nancy Reagan telling you not to do drugs.
Just so way back then, when in the 80s, Michael, I can't remember who it was. Someone went on a talk show and was making fun of these phrases that can be said in multiple ways to interpret them. Like, who do you think you are, anyway? Or what's that up there
Angelica?
In the road, ahead?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And a friend of mine came up with one for Nancy Reagan that was a modification of the Just Say No campaign, which was, just say no. Yeah, I know.
Oh, no,
it's like
I don't need
D,
that.
It's like an A to D joke. I spent the last weekend doing tons of Sketchfest stuff because this is the time of San Francisco Sketchfest. I did Friday night, I did Thrilling Adventure Hour.
Ooh.
Saturday night, I did fake TED Talks at Cobb's. Last
did
night.
You do what was your fake TED Talk, Adam?
I actually did a cover of an old Laurie Anderson song.
Okay.
Which I know sounds strange, but it's a song that is more of a spoken word piece about sperm that is very funny. One of the things, like, nobody remembers Laurie Anderson, and we should because she's really important and she's still around and still making great music and very funny and just a brilliant cultural commentator. And to me, she was the sound of the song Oh Superman is literally. For me, the soundtrack of my 5 years in Manhattan from 85 to 90. And this song is, it's called Mach 20. And I performed it with pitch modulated voice and projection on the background. And it went over really well. It was really fun. And I got the courage to do a cover from Jonathan Coulton, who his last album a couple of years ago was all covers of 70s songs he loved.
I mean, just to be clear, his cover of Baby Got Back remains one of the funniest songs I've ever heard.
You mean
heard.
The one that Glee stole outright?
I mean, look.
Even down to saying Johnny C?
Look, they clearly, all learned a lot about RIAA licensing as a result of that.
Anyway, so Colton's last album is all covers of 70 songs. If you haven't gotten it, you should. It's amazing. And, I've spent a lot of time talking to Jonathan about what he got out of putting that together, conceiving it, and executing it. And I see how much one can learn as an artist by taking somebody else's work and recapitulating it way past karaoke, but something really vital can come out of that. You can really understand it.
It's the same as recreating a prop, right?
You
have something you love
yeah.
and you want to make it your version of it. Why not?
And so, and then last night I did Doug Benson's podcast, I Love Movies, was really fun. Jonah Ray, Arden, and Rob Corddry. That was really entertaining. And then last night I did Margaret Cho's podcast.
Wow. That's a good week.
Kevin MacDonald. Yeah. And wait, what did I do Thursday? Now I'm drawing a blank on Thursday, and I did something that night too.
This is the challenge of being a Bay Area resident during Sketchfest. Oh, no. Because there's like 8 things a day that you want to go see.
Yeah, no. And for me, it's like I haven't been home in an evening in 5 nights, and I can't wait. Literally, when we're done here, I'm going home to just chill and not do a damn thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, on that note,
I want to give a shout out. I know we have a lot of listeners who work at Disney Imagineering. WI, yes. And they just opened the Rise of the Resistance ride in Disneyland. It's been open in Orlando for a while. And from all accounts, it's their proudest achievement. It's a dark ride. It's in the Galaxy's Edge Star Wars land. And
it's not on tracks, right?
Well, if I don't know too much about the technical aspects. I'm looking forward to riding it, hopefully, okay, in a couple of weeks or so. As opposed to being on tracks, the individual vehicles that you're in are basically
autonomous cars.
Autonomous cars.
Oh, nice.
Exactly. Yeah. And they also have like multi-axis movement.
Omni wheels.
But I believe it's like a 17-minute ride.
Nice.
Because they can just push people through.
Yeah.
Oh, right, right. Car,
and there's
car,
multiple
car.
Paths and the whole thing.
Oh,
yeah.
So they made, cool.
It's a packet switch network of people, basically.
And yeah, I can't wait to see it from a production standpoint. And from it's all their technology put into one ride.
What? That's awesome.
Rise of the Resistance. And I know it opened in L.A. and people were like waiting 11 p.m. the night before to ride it the next day. So it's going to be madness for a long time.
They said this at the beginning, and then the park was empty for the first 6 months.
No, it didn't happen. Didn't happen for this
time. Okay.
Yeah. It's also, if any of you who do work there and can get us in, it's also a request.
Oh.
For that. I now see the what's whole happening. Point yeah. of this exercise.
I would like to see the best thing you've ever done.
Yes. Okay.
Anything coming up on the site this week?
We have super exciting week. Later today, we have the video of Adam Yu and Jen Schachter really go through the details of the cricket cart that she made over the holidays.
Nice, yes.
And I believe Jen will have details on where you can actually build your own. She done entire schematics.
Oh, great. Part lists, I've been watching her working on them all week.
So please support that effort and pick that up. And then, we can't see exactly what it is, but I think on Wednesday we're going to have our first video of a long series of videos that will be going on through its entire year.
It's going to blow your minds! An
amazing project. Yeah. This is the thing that's literally been off camera that we can't talk about.
Oh. And that thing.
And so you'll be able to see it Wednesday.
That's pretty exciting.
Right there,
it's really
behind the camera.
It's really it's very good.
So much fun. So much fun.
Thank you guys for joining us. Sorry for the bummer at the front, but
hug your dogs.
Look, yeah.
Enjoy your dogs.
Enjoy them.
Exactly.
Yeah. And like, man, they smell good. See y'all next week.
Bye guys.
Bye. Thanks.